Hi, I'm Jerry Ellis, host of Talking Apes. As a young cameraman filming in Central Africa in the late 1990s, I heard stories about a mystery ape emerging from the Congo. Often called the Heart of Darkness for its dense and secretive rainforest, the Congo was, and still is, a wilderness poorly explored, full of mysteries waiting to be discovered. Well, I was immediately captivated, and I have been ever since. And so were others, it seems, like my next guest, Dr. Cleve Hicks, now associate professor at the University of Wausau. In the early 2000s, Cleve joined with others to search for this mystery ape. It was supposed to be half gorilla, half chimp. Some said it could walk bipedally. Others rumored that the ape was so powerful it was capable of killing lions and leopards. What was Cleve going after?
This could be a missing link between two species of gorillas, or maybe a new species of ape. We didn't know what we were going to find. Maybe it's a hybrid between a chimp and a gorilla.
And with that, the search for the mystery ape from Congo's remote and dangerous Bili region was on. In this episode of Talking Apes, Cleve takes us on that original journey and highlighting discoveries like ground nesting and complex tool use that have driven his curiosity and continued exploration over the past 20 years. Joining us is Cleve's colleague, Italian wildlife biologist and primatologist, Tony Romani. Forced in part by civil war and dangerous gold mining mafias in the Bili region, the two are now working 800 kilometers north, over the border in the forests of western Uganda near Lake Albert. There they continue to discover and explore the complexities of ape nesting and tool use. Their research lending relevance to our understanding of the factors that may have played a role in our ancestors abandoning the trees to venture onto the ground for a bipedal future. Thanks for sharing part of your day with me on Talking Apes. You're listening to the podcast that gets to the heart of what's happening with and to apes like us. Talking Apes is made possible through the generous support of listeners like you and through our growing Patreon members program. To support Talking Apes, start by visiting our website at talkingapes.org. That's talkingapes, one word, .org. And there you can choose to donate or become a monthly Patreon member. Before we jump in with Cleve and Tony, just a quick note. Coordinating this podcast was a conversation challenge spanning across 10 hours and multiple time zones. Cleve was in Bogota, Colombia, and Tony was traveling in South Africa. And unfortunately, power cuts interrupted much of what Tony's input would have been. So technical challenges aside, here was my fascinating conversation about the mysterious Bili ape and what we've learned. Cleve, Tony, welcome to Talking Apes. Hey, I was thinking maybe before we get started and jump into Bili apes and nest building and stick use and all kinds of things, maybe we can have you guys introduce yourselves and explain a little bit about how you guys got connected.
It's great to be here. And Tony, I'll let you go first.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. It's really great to be and to share our research. And it appeared to me, Cleve, in 2018. It's fairly recently. While I was in Warsaw doing a field work on birds, and the lab where I was working organized a conference on the Bili apes. And that is when I met Cleve. Cleve that hooked me up with the Bili area, giving a conference. And then there was an opportunity at Warsaw, Warsaw University under Cleve's grant, and I applied for it, and I jumped in his project, and he welcomed me in the project.
We had a tough selection process for a PhD candidate to work with our nature culture program at the University of Warsaw. It needed to be somebody who had the proper academic background and skills, but also somebody who could. You know, originally our plan was to go to DR Congo and do a year-long field project. And it really takes a fine balance of a person who can handle the academic challenges and paper writing and these kind of things, but also like function in deep in the forest in DR Congo. It ended up being Uganda in Tony's case, but still you need somebody who can, handle, walking all day through the forest getting bitten by ticks and stung by bees and all these kind of things to follow the chimps, but also then can, you know, function in the academic setting. And Tony was the perfect candidate. It was just, it was great to have him in the audience. So we interviewed a number of candidates. A lot of them were very good, but we ended up going with Tony, and it was a great, you know, great decision.
Maybe, Cleve, let's start, since you you began with the Billy Apes, and my background connected to them is through Carl Amon, who is not a scientist, but has spent an incredible amount of time in Congo area of the world. And maybe you could just tell us a little bit about what a Billy Ape, we thought a Billy Ape was, or weren't sure what it was, and where this is in the world. And then maybe tell me about your experience, your early experience in 2004, trying to figure out what a Billy Ape was and would be.
Yes, indeed. It was Carl Amon and his work that first attracted my attention to the Billy chimpanzees, Billy Apes. At the time, we didn't know they were the Billy chimpanzees. They were known as the Billy Apes because precisely we didn't know exactly what they were. We were getting these reports out of northern DRC where, by the way, at that time, it was thought this was not good habitat for great apes. And so if you look at maps from 20-some years ago, even you know, in primatology books, you'll see a big gap up there. Not saying that we don't know if there's chimps there or not, but basically saying there aren't any apes there. And I just had this feeling this couldn't be right. And then we got these reports from Carl Amon coming out from this Billy area of ground nesting on the ground. And I had been recently working with gorillas in the Central African Republic, and so I was quite familiar with ground nests. They're normally associated with gorillas. But we didn't know anything. Nobody had really seen these apes. Carl Amon had gotten a few camera trap pictures that looked like chimps, but maybe big chimps. And there were rumors flying around that maybe this was some kind of a new species. This was it was theorized perhaps this was a population bridging the two species of gorilla that survive today, the eastern gorillas, such as the mountain gorillas, and the western gorillas, which I had actually been studying before at Mondica. So this could have been Gorilla Ualensis. Carl Amon has written a chapter on that in a book, What Happened to Gorilla Ualensis. Because it is quite odd that you have in the distribution, chimpanzees go right across the tropical forest belt of Africa, but gorillas are found in two clusters, two different species of gorilla, western lowlands and eastern gorillas, mountain gorillas. And in between, there's no gorillas. What happened to them? Well, there was a skull found there that Carl Amon had documented that had a big sagittal crest. It seemed like a gorilla skull, found about 100 years ago. So it was thought maybe we'd get there and hear chest beating and find ground nesting and all sorts of things like gorillas. This could be a missing link between two species of gorillas. Or even wilder speculation, maybe it's a hybrid between a chimp and a gorilla, or maybe a new species of ape. We didn't know what we were going to find. At that time, some scientists, including Christoph Busch, and others had accompanied Carl Amon there, and they had done genetic testing. So it did show that it was chimps, in fact, eastern chimps. But there was a lot of hype about this, and it was actually kind of my job over the next few years to kind of throw cold water on this sort of Bigfoot in the forest kind of, what, you know, new species idea. And these are chimps. But what we actually found was, I find, as interesting, which is a new culture of chimpanzees, the Biliowere behavioral realm, as I would later term it. And we found that it's possibly the largest connected culture set of traditions of chimpanzees left in Africa.
I want to get back to that term culture in a few minutes. But physically, the Billy Ape, what were the key characteristics of it that, well, first of all, was this the skull that was found with the sagittal crest, was it in fact a chimpanzee skull?
It was a gorilla skull. But later genetic, you can actually read about this in Carl Amon's chapter, later genetic tests revealed that it was actually more closely related to Western gorillas. In fact, was a Western gorilla skull. So the idea was probably it was something that was carried in a boat up the Congo River or up the Owelle River or something and left in a village 100 years ago. It was found by a fellow named Le Marinel, I believe, if I remember right, a Belgian explorer. And so it actually was a misplaced gorilla skull. But Carl Amon did document some chimp skulls from the same region with at least one, maybe two, with sagittal crests. And so this was still lending some hope to the idea that this might be some kind of a hybrid. Well, genetic testing later would reveal that this is not the case. There was a scientist named Shelley Williams who went in there and got a got some images of the Beely apes. There were reports from local people that these chimps were kind of lion killers. There was you'll see that there might be something to that story. You always have to, local people know more about these great apes than we ever will, their behavior, their where you find them, et cetera. But you always have to take some of these stories with a bit of a grain of salt. But we'll see that in terms of Beely apes killing big cats, there's some evidence that actually happened.
Really? Wow. And it's lions or leopards or
what? Well, they were called the lion killers by local people who said that they could, that the ones on the ground could kill lions. We actually found a leopard carcass. Legata Faustin, who was the most excellent field assistant that we had there, a local Zande guy who was like a ninja of the forest. He would actually set off 2 days after our main team went out to the forest camps. And we would walk 3 days through the forest. He would walk day and night in the dark by himself and show up at our camp. He was like a forest ninja, but he also took really good data. He took GPS points. He wrote it in French, his notes. He witnessed a Beely chimpanzee in the Gangu forest, hunched over the carcass of a leopard, biting and chewing into it. He brought the paw back to us, showing it was definitely a leopard paw. And so this is some evidence we have that there is some truth to the idea of the Beely apes as big cat eaters or killers or, some danger to big cats.
Hmm. Wow. That's really fascinating, especially in light of a recent podcast that we did, podcast guest we had, who actually studies the tooth marks and engravings on bones, looking at early connections to humans as scavengers and hunters. So the idea, and one of the directions that she looks is at chimpanzees and their hunting skills and killing, usually smaller things, smaller monkeys, pigs, small antelope. But the idea of a chimps killing a cat is.
You'll like this too. There, in the same chapter where we describe this, there's a book chapter I can give a link to you. I cite John Hart, who is a very well-known researcher, American researcher who's worked in Congo for 30 years. He and a Congolese assistant witnessed two male chimps hunched over the carcass of an okapi, a young okapi in the Apulu forest. This was like 30 years ago, apparently biting into the brain case. And they think the chimps might have pirated it from a leopard because the okapi seemed to have been killed by a leopard. This to me is mind blowing, and I was very glad to be able that we could put this into the chapter. This observation.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting because it does fit directly into the things that Brianna Pobiner is the researcher at the Smithsonian Institute who we're talking with. So we'll have a cross link from this over to the podcast we did with her. It's fascinating, but it ties in very nicely to that. Maybe I'll put you guys in touch. I'm fascinated at this connection of the ground nesting. So you were looking at gorillas and had experience in looking at gorilla ground nesting nests. So when you went in initially to look at Beely's, you started seeing ground nesting in there?
Yeah. And this is in the paper that Tony and I published pretty recently. We actually found a substantial percentage of ground nests in the Beely population. This is unusual because normally chimps, in most populations of chimps and other great apes, including bonobos and orangutans, they sleep in the trees. So gorillas are well known for their nesting on the ground. In the Virungas, for instance, almost 100% of their nests are ground nests. Whereas in some populations, it's somewhere between 7% of their nests are ground nests. There's a wide range, but all gorilla populations make some of their nests on the ground. Most chimp populations don't. And so finding that in some forests in the Beely area, up to 30% of the nests are ground nests. And so this was a very large region, possibly all of northern DRC, where the chimps are routinely sleeping on the ground. A lot of them are likely night nests. So this was, to me, a big discovery. And it also has relevance to human evolution.
Yeah, let's talk about that because that seems incredibly dangerous. I mean, the times that I've been over the last couple of decades with chimps in the wild, mostly have only seen tree nesting, which makes total sense because if you've got leopards or lions or whatever, large carnivores in the area, that seemed like it would pose an incredible danger if you're nesting at night on the ground.
Yeah, Yeah, it might be a danger, but we have to remember that leopards can climb as well. So it's not necessarily a protection, or it's not always a protection. And actually, what we found in the Billy paper, in the Billy ground nesting, they tend to prefer to nest on the ground in thick and very dense forest. So that means that the forest is protected. They are searching a sort of protection, of natural protection. So probably the nest height is not really important. It's more important how it looks like the forest. So if it's very open forest, maybe they tend to go higher because the visibility is better. Whereas if it's denser, they stay on the ground. It's like a cozy room where it's hard to be seen. It's a sort of protection, let's say.
So when you find these ground nests in that case, is the proximity of the nests close to one another? Like, do you find a group of the nests, or are they spread just like they would be in trees?
Well, you can find nests, solid lone nests, so just one nest on the tree or one nest on the ground. But also you can find clusters of nests. And we considered one cluster when the nests were of the same age, built on the same time, and far apart one from each other, less than 20 meters. So if the nests were one from each other, from the nearest nest was less than 20 meters, was from the same cluster, otherwise was from different groups. And sometimes happens that they're coming in the same area in different periods, after a few months, depending on the food availability and their movement. Yeah,
right. What do they call those in Uganda, Tony? When you have these,
when you have huge huge nest sites with different clusters, one of our local collaborators, they define them chimpala, which is chimpanzee, and Kampala, which is the capital of Uganda. So the Chimpala, a huge city. We found sometimes almost more than 100.
Chim village.
Yeah. More than 100 nests. Yeah. One
Chimpala,
different
right.
ages. And it was amazing.
Yeah. It's like they, you know, and if you think about early humans coming back to like a common point where they would meet up again and again and share information and stuff, you have to think that these chimps, when they keep coming back to the same ground nesting area or the same nesting area and sleeping there over and over again, it might be a place where they kind of convene and share information or meet up again, have your reunions. It's a really fascinating kind of a place to see, like a little chimp village.
I guess the reason I asked the question was I was wondering if when chimps were on the ground, they tended to be in the nest tended to be in a tighter cluster, and that would offer more protection. I mean, if you were higher up, if you're on the ground and there's a dozen of you nesting very close to one another, if one chimp is alarmed, they can alarm everybody. If a cat approached, versus in a tree, you could be a bit more spread out.
Actually, Tony, I'm not sure we've looked at that, have we? But it's actually a really interesting idea. If we find that the average distance in between ground nests is closer than the, say, the average distance between tree nests or tree nests and ground nests, that actually would be something maybe we could look at if we haven't already looked at it. I actually like this suggestion.
Yeah, but there's another thing to consider.
I think so. And it feels like that.
Sorry. Right? There's one thing I think we need to consider when chimpanzees are communicating. There are different ways of communication, and there's not only grunts or very short alarm calls, but they're also long distance. So probably sometimes they're sleeping on the ground, and they can check all the other nests. And in fact, one of the theories is that ground nesting is mate guarding behavior, which we were not able to test from the Billy data. Although, given the large amount of ground nests per nest site, we found up to 14 ground nests in one nest site together with three nests. It sounds unlikely; it's just males making nests on the ground. But we couldn't test it genetically, so I don't know if it's more safe on the ground or if it's safer on the trees. It depends also the escape routes. How many escape routes, given the area, given on the tree, can give the chimpanzee more safety compared to a ground nest?
Hey, Cleve, you know, it just dawned on me that there might be a bit of confusion about the term nest. Maybe we should pause for a moment and talk about what these nests really are.
There's actually a bit of a danger sometimes in referring to great ape nests as nests, because that makes it sound like they're the equivalent of bird nests. But bird nests are actually usually structures that last for a long time. You think of the mothers raising the young in the nest. Chimpanzee nests, some people refer to them as sleeping platforms or even beds, because actually they're usually made fresh every night and abandoned the next morning. And then the chimps may go off 5 kilometers and build another nest site near another fruiting tree. So they're more like almost like campsites. They kind of give you this impression of being campsites. And what they do is they get up, usually in the trees, but also as we see now on the ground, and they bend in branches inward to create a sort of comfortable sleeping platform, sometimes, you know, 40 feet up in the canopy. And then they sometimes will rip off other branches and put them down as kind of pillows or cushions inside the nest. And they sleep there overnight. And then they climb down the next morning and they leave that nest forever. There's very little, there are very few cases of reuse of nests, certainly not at Beely. Whereas, you know, if we think of home bases with humans, these might have been more permanent structures. Think of people now building houses. This is not exactly the equivalent of what apes do, although certainly I'd imagine our human sort of houses and beds and things started off that way. I'd imagine our ancestors must have also made elaborate tree or ground nests to sleep in. And at some point, they might have become more permanent structures like, say, birds' nests and become houses. But whatever the case, that's going to be very informative to understanding, you know, how our earliest ancestors would have slept, presumably starting off like non-human great apes and then progressing to what we have today, where we, you know, build these very, you know, sometimes even protect our sleeping spots using bomas, which are sort of spiky vegetation arranged around the sleeping area for people. Another thing that I think is important to mention is that monkeys don't make nest night nests to sleep in. Neither do gibbons, which is actually another kind of ape. So it seems like great apes evolved this nest making ability. You know, even orangutans use night nests. And this, some researchers have theorized that this is actually the ancestral tool. It's kind of debatable as to whether nests can be considered tools or not, but it's definitely altering your habitat in order to make it more comfortable for you to live in, which is something we humans have just gone crazy doing. And it's something that seems to be shared with all non-human great apes. And we humans make our own sort of nests, but it's really a common shared behavior of all non-human great apes and human ones too.
I find this so fascinating because the implications for like thinking about how early humans, for example, would have started developing a sense of community, chimpala idea, you know, how do you develop a village and what are the benefits and the hazards of creating this kind of community structure. And that's why this work is so fascinating to me, because it seems to ask more questions than you have answers at the moment.
Yeah, we're only just scratching the surface of some of the reasons why these chimps, you know, might prefer to sleep on the ground in some occasions. And in some areas, they don't at all. In fact, the majority of chimp populations, they're sleeping in trees. Is this possibly just cultural? You know, we think of human, you know, even if you go travel across Africa, you'll find very different styles of housemaking from one region to another in Congo, and certainly across the world is even more extreme. But, you know, there's a big role for culture in that with humans, obviously. Obviously, humans are also like, it's not only explained by culture. Some of it's raw materials that you would have to build a house. Like, you don't have ice in the Congo, so you can't make an igloo, you know. So that there is definitely some ecological reasons for the kind of houses, the differences in the houses we make, but there's also culture. And it's that same factor at play in chimpanzees. And was it at play in our own ancestors? So we're trying to tease out the different factors that might lead chimps to make not just whether they nest on the ground or not, but we're actually working now on some papers where we're looking at the styles of nest construction, about tree nests. Tony was actually quite good at, I was sometimes worried for him, but he would, in Uganda, he would, you know, he would climb up into tree nests and low ones and try and figure out the structure of them, but also ground nesting. Yeah, right. But also just the structure and our, you know, what I think we might find, I hope we find, I don't know if that's what we're going to find, across this whole area, you may find a shared architectural structure of these nests, a shared preference for certain plants, which could be cultural. And for instance, in Fongoli, which is in West Africa, and this incredible savanna site with Jill Preutz does her work there. The chimps make their ground nests out of a significant portion of their ground nests out of savanna grass. Well, we have savanna grass at Beely, and yet we've never seen one chimpanzee ground nest made of savanna grass, despite the wide availability of it. It's not that they don't have the savanna grass to use. Is it a cultural difference, or is there some other factor at play? We're going to be looking at all of these kind of things. We've only just scratched the surface with our first papers, and we're just going to dig a lot deeper into this. And one of the most exciting things that I can find is we're now entering into collaborations with some different researchers, Anne Ladiswat and some of her Congolese co-workers, Achille Diodo, and others who are starting to share methodology, and we're starting to look at the structure of these ground nests in different areas and see how they're connected and how they relate to one another. Very exciting.
Yeah. Tony, you mentioned just a second ago the genetics. So are we able to tease out of these nests? I know with gorillas, for example, the hair left in the nest, we can get some indication as to which individuals were there, which the age of those individuals, whether they're silverbacks, blackbacks, babies were in the, you know, youngsters were in the nest, mothers and infants, that kind of thing. What are we able to get that kind of information out of these chimp nests?
Well, the information we can get, at least from the freshness, if the nest is old, after 2-3 weeks, you cannot find even less, probably 2-3 days, you cannot find any air. And dung is too degraded to be analyzed. But for sure, when you find hair, you know that, or it's more likely that the nest is a night nest, because the leaves are used, and so there is more hair left into the nest. Differentiate between individuals, between males and females, silverbacks. I mean, the chimpanzees that don't have silverbacks, so it's very hard to differentiate between individuals, between sexes and adults and youngs. I don't think it will be possible. The thing, some of the nests we heard the chimpanzee leaving, and so approaching the nest when the chimpanzee have left, so you can assure if it's early in the morning that it was a night nest. Otherwise, with non-habituated populations, it's very hard to tell them apart. So hair is a good proxy to say it's more likely a ground nest, a night nest. Sorry.
I mean, we do have hair and dung samples, especially from Bagoma, a few from Congo, but more from Bagoma. We're working on those now with one of our collaborators in Warsaw. And ideally, what would be great is if we could figure out the sexes of the ground nesters to test the mate guarding hypothesis. Kat Copes has done some of this from West Africa, Nimba site. And also, I really hope we can actually determine if ground nesting... A little hint of what we've seen is in different regions of, and I won't go into too much detail on this yet, but in Bagoma, we have found in different regions of the forest, different percentages, ratios of ground nests to tree nests, including one area where we didn't find any ground nests at all, and we found a lot of nests. So the question is, do these represent different communities of chimps? They are habituating one group, the Moera group of chimps in Bagoma, and they've studied ground nests there. But the other groups aren't, communities aren't habituated. So from the circumstantial evidence, we have some ideas of what we think might be happening, and it might be really cool in terms of differential making of ground nests across the region, but we need to test that with genetics. And we're only at the very beginning of that process, and we'll see how it goes, if we can even do that. I have high hopes that we can actually sort of use the genetics to help us tell a little bit about what's happening across this whole region, not just one community.
I would think that ground nests decay much more rapidly, especially in a wet forest. Is that a problem when you're looking at ground nests versus tree nests?
Yeah, we just published a couple of months ago a paper on that, where we analyzed 107 nests. Half of them were tree nests, and half of them were ground nests. And as you well said, what we observed is ground nests decaying more than 1 month faster than tree nests. There can be multiple reasons. It can be animals just stamping on it, humans walking in the forest, or just branches collapsing on them and just completely disappearing, or just the branches which are used to make the ground nests just opening up and springing up to the air and just making them not anymore visible. Whereas tree nests, they stay if they are not too high. If they are less than 15 meters high, this is what we observe, they can last more than 1 year. But then you have also species used. There are some species some tree species that can last very long, especially. The one we found in Bugoma is in Runyoro, is a Musetera, which is one of the Merua species. We found more than one year, 1 year in a couple of months. It was still present, still visible. But generally, when the tree nest is lower, if the tree nest is higher up, more than 15 meters, let's say, the wind will also help to make it disentangle and disappear. And it's curious. One thing we didn't mention, the way they're building the ground nest is very similar to the way they're building the tree nest. They're making the structure and then a mattress. Exactly, it's very similar. The principle, let's say, is exactly the same. Just instead of branches, they have the ground.
Can I add something here?
Yeah, please do.
One of the problems is what we found in Bugoma with the nest decay. The ground nest decaying quicker than tree nests. The question is that the same in all different forests? Because different forests may have different patterns of wet and dry season. There may be more big animals in some forests that would destroy ground nests, where in some forests there aren't any large animals left. Humans have killed them all, so the ground nests would stay further intact. The question is, does this finding apply to other sites as well? We don't know yet, and we would like to encourage people to look at this, get nest decay rate data from various sites with and without ground nests. We have found one indication that this may actually apply to other sites as well. At Beely, if we were to find a new nest site, we would find a higher ratio of ground nests to tree nests than for old nest sites. So the older the nest site, the lower percentage of ground nests we'd find. And this, we argue in the paper, indicates that perhaps this is a rule that applies across chimpanzee range in Africa. But we really need to do more hands-on research to make sure that's correct.
What would that mean that you would have, as the older the site, the more tree nests versus ground nests? What I'm trying to interpret what that means.
So if ground nests, as Tony found in his nest visits in Uganda, if ground nests decay quicker, a month quicker, or even more in some areas perhaps, than tree nests, you would expect for old nest sites, let's say 6 months old, you would expect to maybe only see tree nests because all the ground nests have already gone. And that's what we found at Beely. The older the nest site, the fewer ground nests we would find. And this, it doesn't prove it, but it's a good indication that this is not just a quirky feature of Bugoma ground nests, but it may be a pattern that applies across chimpanzee range. But we need to look more in detail at that, and we need a collaboration between different research groups, especially Congolese and Ugandan researchers who I met quite a few in Kisangani at a conference earlier this year, who are easily able to get to a lot of these sites and have very good eyes in the forest. And we're actually in discussion now with a lot of local researchers on looking for these things. And they're already starting to take some of these things into account when they're doing their surveys. So it's quite exciting.
Yeah, and regarding to that, if I may add one thing, there's another thing.
Yeah, please.
it's very hard. It's very difficult to see a ground nest. Because what you will see when you observe something is a broken pattern. And the tree nest is a broken pattern in the canopy. And we are used to look up and to see something, and we are able to locate tree nests. Whereas it happened several times that me as well as other collaborators were walking on the ground and just stamping on the ground nest, and just then realizing that you just passed over a ground nest. It happens. It doesn't happen often because after you train yourself with a search image, you start looking on the ground carefully, and so you learn how to find it. But it's very important to have this as a search image; otherwise, you're not able to. Or it's very hard to see it.
Very good point. Yeah, raising consciousness to look for certain things that are not in our search image, and also, by the way, our finding in the Beely paper that human hunting, but not other activities, shut down ground nesting in chimps. Well, if you do stay in a village in Congo and there are chimps living nearby, and you go out and do surveys and count all the nests, you might not find any ground nests at all. Maybe it's just because those chimps are being hunted, and so they're not sleeping on the ground. If you just went a 5 kilometers further into the forest, as we see in Beely, you'll start seeing ground nests pop up much more frequently because there's less human pressure on them. So all these kind of biases, and not just with nesting, but with tools and other things, you know, we want to try to raise consciousness also with ourselves too, because we also have blind spots. When people are going out and doing a, you know, could be doing a great job counting chimp nests, but they're missing other things that with just a little effort, you could get a whole bunch more data.
The thing that's fascinating about that to me is for so many years, nests are almost our only way of estimating populations. So when we're trying to develop conservation strategies, it's based on, well, how many individuals are there? What kind of space do they need? And what kind of space are they utilizing for habitat and territory? And if you're missing a lot of nests, you might be completely off on your population estimates.
Absolutely. So there's a 2014 paper that I was first author on, basically announcing this huge new population of chimps that hadn't been documented before in northern Congo. But we didn't even use the ground nests, which were about 10% of all the nests that we found, in our population estimates based on the nests we found, because we weren't sure. We couldn't prove that these were ground nests were night nests. We argue in our recent papers that the majority of them probably were. And so actually, Tony and Roger Mundry and I and others in Tony's latest paper have actually argued we should factor in that differential in decay rates for ground nests when we're coming up with it. You should count those ground nests, especially if they're complex ones, not just leaf cushions or flimsy ones. If we had done that in our 2014 paper, we could have added, 10% more, chimps to the population.
In some areas, that could be really a significant number, I would think, on how it impacts your conservation strategy. When we come back, Cleve will describe what it was like to journey into Beely country, often a multi-day adventure of dodgy bush flights and sketchy motorcycle journeys. And we'll also take a deeper dive into the stick tool technology appearing across this entire region. But before our Beely adventure begins, let's check in with assistant producer Demelza Bond. Hey there, Demelza.
Hello, everyone. Speaking of new tools and technologies, something a bit more advanced than sticks. If you're a TikTok or Tumblr user, then good news, because we've now got brand new profiles on both of those platforms. So they're a bit too hip and trendy for me and Jerry. So we've got our lovely volunteers, Zoe and Theo, running those accounts. So go say hey to them, give us a follow. And if you want links for them, I've just posted a blog on our website, talkingapes.org, with the links to both our new TikTok and our new Tumblr. We've had many more very heartwarming listener writings. Grey Bullock wrote, she said, "Hello, my name's Grey. I live in England. I'm a big fan of Talking Apes and I love orangutans so much. It's my passion in life to try and help them, so I support orangutan charities as much as I can and try to raise awareness. I've never met any of the orangutans that I sponsor, but they mean the world to me and I love them more than I can ever describe. Talking Apes is my favourite podcast. Thank you so much." Well, thank you so much, Grey. That is just so nice and we're really glad you're enjoying it. Ishika Ramakrishna wrote in and said, I genuinely enjoy listening to this pod. I run my own wildlife podcast, and being an early career primatologist, this is right up my alley. Thanks for producing these insightful episodes. Thank you, Ishika. Good luck with your podcast, and make sure you send us a link to one of your recent episodes so we can have a listen back. Someone who works at Project Gap Brazil wrote in and said, thank you for promoting such important things. As the majority of our followers are from Brazil, I translated the main information to Portuguese on our Instagram. Keep up the nice work with the podcast. I just think that is so lovely that you took the time to share our work and to translate it as well. So I'll certainly return the favour and tell our listeners, go and check out Project Gap. They describe themselves as a project that defends the rights of non-human apes, and they do have an English version of the website in case you don't speak Portuguese. Thank you to everyone who asks how you can help support Talking Apes. The best thing you can do right now is join our growing Patreon troop. It's a community of monthly givers. We send our patrons exclusive email updates, and all members get a small discount on merch. Speaking of merch, if you haven't checked out our online store, please go and do that. We've got a gorgeous little range of hoodies and sweatshirts and t-shirts, all adorned with the Talking Apes logo. Podcasting's expensive and it's really time consuming, and we do this on top of all our other great ape conservation projects under our non-profit Globio. So if you like what we're doing, please consider supporting us. Links to both Patreon and the merch store are at the top of our website, talkingapes.org. As always, make sure you like, subscribe, leave us a 5-star rating, and come and chat to us on socials. We're a tiny team, so anything we can do to grow this podcast is fantastic. And if you've got any animal or nature lovers amongst your friends or family, do tell them about us. We really appreciate it. That's enough of me. Now back to Jerry with our wonderful chimp chasing experts, Cleve and Tony.
Thanks, Demelza. And now back to my conversation with Cleve and Tony. Can you describe that area and how difficult and remote it is?
Wow. It's when I first arrived there back in 2004, it was one of the least human impacted places I've ever seen on Earth. And I've been to a lot of really cool remote places also here in Colombia and even in Europe. The Białowieża forest in Poland, for instance, is gorgeous. But this place, well, the problem is it is very difficult to get to. So either we flew a missionary plane in, but you had to clear the airstrip first. And it's extremely remote. Or it's like a week-long motorbike drive, and your motorbike is breaking down, you know, because you have to drive your motorbike through a flooded road that is up to pretty much your hips on the motorbike. Big clouds of smoke coming out of the motorbike. Fortunately, my motorbike driver, Sebo, was master at fixing broken motorbikes. But to get there is really, really difficult. And I think that's part of the reason a lot of the wildlife has survived. And also, by the way, I would say a unique human culture, the Zande, who, you know, they have a pretty light footprint on the forests that they live with. I mean, they certainly eat meat. They have taboos against eating chimps and things. But the more that these places become connected to big cities, you know, through logging operations or through, in northern DRC, it's more gold mining and diamond mining is just, then the more these unique human traditions are lost. And including taboos against killing certain animals and just a different way of using wildlife than the ones that mass consumerism does. And it was, I think, because this place was so remote, that's what allowed not only chimps, but elephants and something like 9 species of other species of non-human primates. This place is amazing. And one of my favorite things about Bili is it was this ecotone where the savanna and the forest come together, which, by the way, is something like where our ancestors would have probably evolved. Not in the open savanna, and at least not at first, and not deep in the forest, but like where these worlds come together. And I think you see there much creativity and much animals trying out different ways of life. We found, you can actually see on my YouTube channel, hyenas that we captured on camera trap. Deep in the forest, usually solitary ones, but what are they doing down in the forest there? And by the way, in that same forest, the same camera trap footage that we got over 8 months, not a single sign of humans, not a single human walked in front of one of those cameras. So when we got there in 2004, this area was one of the most untouched areas on the planet. I wouldn't say that, you know, there were certainly bushmeat being killed there. The Zande, you know, they you know, eat a lot of wildlife. But at the same time, very low footprint. Unfortunately, a lot of this is changing now as you're having gold mining and diamond mining enterprises coming in, funded by Chinese and Americans and Russians and everybody all mixed in. And we're real risks of losing this this beautiful place.
Why did you? So you were studying here in the Bili area, and then you jump up to this area called Bugoma, in which is on the eastern side of Lake Albert in Uganda. Why there versus anywhere else? What made you shift from the Bili area to a completely different area to start doing nest research?
That's a great question. I mean, I love DR Congo, but I will say it's an incredibly unstable place to work. You put, you know, years of work into a certain area, and then gold miners come in or elephant poachers come in, and you have to move out. And it's really hard to do something like that lasts there. It kind of breaks your heart sometimes. So we had actually lost our project in Bili because several thousand gold miners invaded the area in 2007. And led to lots of violence towards the human population and lots of killing of elephants. So I had this year left of PhD research funding. I ended up doing a survey to the south of the Oeli River, 300 kilometers south, because we basically couldn't go back to the Bili area. And that's where we found the same kind of behaviors far away, which is what gave me an idea for this behavioral realm. So what I wanted to do is, there was indications that this Bili Oeri chimpanzee behavioral realm extends all the way to the Apulu forest in eastern Congo. And again, I think I mentioned to you before that we had a plan to go and work in Apulu, where our collaborator John Hart and Therese Hart had worked for decades, done amazing work there, and had documented some chimpanzee behaviors, including ground nesting. And I was there for a week and found ground nests. Tony was supposed to come with me, as a PhD student. We were going to do a year-long work in Apulu. Well, let's just say that instability got the better of us. There was an Ebola outbreak about that time. This was just before COVID pandemic broke out. There were some rebel attacks. We weren't able to make it work to establish a long-term camp in Apulu. So we ended up flying to Uganda, got out of Poland just 3 days before all the airplanes were shut down. And Tony and I ended up working there, added all up for a couple of years at the field site put together by Kat Hobater. I think you've interviewed her on this program, and Thibaut Gruber. They're habituating this group of chimps there, and they're doing amazing work. A lot's going to come out about Bugoma soon. We focus only on the ground nesting. The idea was for me and Tony to be there together, to train together, so we're sure we're seeing the same things with nests. And then I was going to fly onto Congo, but then COVID didn't allow that. And I was actually really impressed with the Ugandan government. Although my permit ran out for being there, they said, just expats who, you know, don't have your papers right, just stay where you are. Don't travel. We don't want to spread this virus. And so I actually stayed there for seven months with Tony, and we found some amazing things, which some of it we can talk about later when the papers are published. But we ended up, and how do we find out about Bugoma? Well, Tony and I were both at a conference at Max Planck, in 2019. And this, student, Harmony Klein, said, "Cleve, what ground nests? I know you found a lot of ground nests in Bili. We're finding the same thing in Bugoma." And this immediately, you know, given the problems we're having with going back to Apulu, this set up our alarm. And we were invited there to work at the site. So Tony and I were actually able to, spend a lot of time there just documenting this ground nesting that seems very similar to the ground nesting of the chimps in Bili. And we're going to look in more detail at the structure of the nests and the plant species they use. One difference is, for instance, the ones at Bugoma very rarely use herbs, even though herbs are there, whereas the ones in Bili frequently use herbs. Is that an indication that these are two independent traditions that evolve separately, or is it the same tradition? And is this part of the Bili Oeli behavioral realm, at least regarding ground nesting, that stretches across all of northern DRC? These are things we're working on now.
What is the distance between Bili and Bugoma? What is the physical distance? What are we talking about here?
something like 800, 900 kilometers. I think about 800. So there's this huge gap in our knowledge between Bungoma and Beeli, which I, you know, was pretty fairly well documented over a huge area in Beeli, 50,000 square kilometers, but all this forest in between, including the Apulu forest and this Rafal forest that Anne Ladiswat, we're collaborating with her, and also Garamba, where Anne Ladiswat and Achille Jojo are working. We don't know, do the chimps make ground nests too? Are they using similar tools that they use in Beeli? All this is stuff we're just starting to look at, and it's extremely exciting time to. Part of it is the collaborative aspect of it. We're all kind of getting the same methodology in our heads and, you know, working together with locals to see, is this just, you know, independent evolution of very similar behaviors, maybe due to some ecological factor across this area? Or is it the same chimp culture spread out across this enormous area? I think it's the latter, but we you know, it's premature to be sure on that.
Okay, so back to Bungoma. So you're trapped there for 7 months because of COVID. And what happened then?
Great place to be trapped during. I felt so bad for people stuck in their apartments. But yeah, so basically that actually what it allowed was Tony and me to really, you know, work together to understand, you know, what we were looking at here. And we worked with the local, basically there were these chimpanzee health monitoring teams going out to look to see the human impact, because actually we found a spike in human illegal activities during the COVID pandemic, maybe because guards weren't able to protect as much. So in the course of that sort of monitoring, we were able to also study ground nesting and tree nests. We got a lot coming out about that very soon. We've only published one paper on it so far, but we also got genetic samples. So we'll be able to look and see if perhaps there might be community differences between nesting habits. Because we know from West Africa that sometimes even neighboring chimp communities can have different ways of, say, using hammers to pound open nuts. Ludia Lunks and her work with Christoph Bosch and others has shown that. So could we see something similar in Bungoma? But this would be an interesting contrast to Northern DRC, where it seems like there's cultural uniformity across a vast area. And this way, it makes me think that chimps are a bit like us. You know, we have like the United States of America, where I'm from, where everybody speaks English or Spanish there's McDonald's everywhere. It's very kind of uniform culture. Whereas you look at Papua New Guinea, you have enormous differences, even in whole language families, between the peak of one mountain and another, which is probably more like what human cultures are like in the past. But chimpanzees may show that same kind of complexity. In some areas, you have what I call these behavioral realms that spread over huge areas. And in some areas, you may have extreme differentiation between neighboring chimp cultures. This is all, we're only just starting to look at sort of these patterns of distribution of cultures, behavioral realms, as I call them, across Africa.
One of the things I think is interesting is when we had Kat Hobater on, she was talking about this idea of digging wells. A female had migrated into one of their habituated groups from another habituated group, and she brought with her this idea of digging holes. And then the chimps in this new group were starting to discover how to do that too by watching this. And so this idea of culture or, you know, technology, I guess you would call it, migrating with individuals from group to group is a fascinating one, and especially when it comes to some of the work that you guys are doing.
Yeah, so I would think I can think of a few different ways that chimp cultures could spread. One is through female transfer, such as you just mentioned from Hobater's research, and also some evidence from Bosu of a female chimp from another region that just automatically knew how to crack open these nuts that the chimps in the group she lived in didn't know. So that's one thing. Another way would just be chimps expanding out across, let's say, neighboring patches of forest through either warfare. If anybody's seen Chimp Empire, you'll see great, terrifying footage of chimps going to war with each other. So if one chimp group takes over the group of a nearby group of chimps and they have unique cult traditions, those traditions may spread that way. Or it could be, and I think this might have happened in Northern DRC, is that most of Northern DRC is very mosaic habitat. A lot of it is like savanna woodland mixed with forests, and it's quite likely that those areas didn't have chimps, you know, at various periods in history. They all were wiped out. For instance, gorillas used to live there, and they're all gone now. But then chimps maybe recolonized these areas. And I think what we're seeing with Beeli, this is just my idea of what might be happening, is the chimps carried with them these traditions from whatever point of origin that these colonizing chimps started, and they recolonized all these returning woodlands and forests in northern DRC, bringing with them their ground nesting, their termite mound pounding, their unique tool use behaviors, and spread them across this enormous area pretty recently. And we need genetic evidence to kind of back this up or test this. But chimp traditions may be somewhat conservative. So even though you have chimps in, say, the Bambesa Buta area living in lush tropical rainforests, and chimps living in the Bili area living more in woodland savanna habitat, they're all making ground nests. They're all pounding open termite mounds in the same way. They're ignoring Macrotermes termite mounds, which Jane Goodall's chimps, the chimps Jane Goodall studied in Gombe, for instance, are famous for fishing for. They seem to share all these behaviors across a wide, wide area. And I think this might tell us something about how hominid tradition spread. Yes, chimps are hominids like we are. We're hominins, but we're also hominids like chimps. And this will tell us something about how traditions may have spread in our own ancestors 6-7 million years ago. So very important for understanding our own evolution, I think, this unique opportunity of northern DRC all the way to Uganda, which is an intact population of chimps.
You know, we've alluded to sticks several times in our conversation. Could you just first describe sticks in general, why the chimps use them, how they're modifying them, and the kinds of uses that they have?
Well, I think we can look at tool use as the use of a detached object, used as an extension of the body in order to process some kind of food or affect the environment around an individual. And chimps are famous for, even in captivity, chimps can just figure out how to break off a stick and use it to explore something, or it just seems to be something chimps generally tend to do. However, chimps have actually developed elaborate stick use cultures across Africa, except for northern Uganda, where they don't do much of it. But in a lot of places, for instance, in the Gabon area and in the central subspecies of chimps, chimps will even use sets of tools in a sequence of stick tools to access honey in arboreal beehives. They'll first use a pounder, which I've actually seen, you know, witnessed a chimp doing, and then they'll bring several other kinds of sticks as a lever, and then finally a probe, like a thin wand as a probe, to access honey. So they're really developed these elaborate stick use traditions in some populations. And why is this so interesting? Not only is it interesting just because it's another case of chimpanzee traditions and that we can see. We can actually observe these sticks even if we don't see the chimps themselves. And that's what a lot of my work has been doing, is using detective work to kind of figure out how the chimps are using these sticks. But also it tells us, when we find tools of ancient hominins, oftentimes the only tools we'll find are stone tools, which we find going back to now, I think, about 3.3 million years old. What we can assume is that our hominin ancestors are only using stone tools. They were probably also using, probably even before they used stone tools, they were probably using stick tools and leaves to access food. But these things don't fossilize. So if we want to understand how hominids use sticks, we need to look at our closest cousins, not just chimps, by the way. Orangutans in at least one population use stick tools, and even a species of South American monkeys, sapajus in Brazil, use stick tools. So what are the factors that lead certain primates, usually very big-brained ones, to start using tools stone tools as an extension of their bodies? And chimps have the most, other than humans, the most elaborate stick tool traditions yet known. And again, what I do is I don't work with habituated chimps. Tony and I don't work with habituated chimps. We go along and we measure tool sites. We treat these fresh chimp tool sites as archaeological sites, in a sense, to measure the length of the tools, to identify the species of insects that they're using the tools to get. And this allows us to compare tool traditions across Africa.
So are these tools, how do you know that they're not just a random stick that's laying on the ground when you find it? I mean, are the chimps actually doing something?
Yeah, they're modifying sticks often. So, I mean, they can theoretically just pick up a stick that's already broken off and use it. But for the most part, we have very strict criteria on what we count as a tool. For instance, if a stick is projecting out of an ant mound, or if multiple sticks are projecting out of an ant mound, I suppose it's possible. And you have to realize that sometimes, just by pure happenstance, a stick can fall out of a tree and land upright, projecting into an ant mound. But if five sticks are sticking out of an ant mound at the same time, and you have chimp knuckle prints all around it, Okay. That the set of criteria would be met that we would call those tools. Also, if they show signs of modification, for instance, the leaves have been ripped off, the ends have been stripped. They show signs of wear, for instance, blunting on the end. I'll tell you a quick story once. I was the first to propose that chimps in Central Africa, this is not Beely, this is 800 kilometers to the west, another subspecies, they actually use stick tools as kind of clubs to pound into arboreal honey mounds. And there was one occasion when I was in the Goto forest trying to document a new chimpanzee tool tradition. When I heard up ahead in the forest, I heard from the treetop, we heard chimps pant hooting. We saw a couple of chimps nearby and we heard this boom, 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 like hammering sound. I asked Pilindon DeBesco, who was our local field assistant, what's going on? He said, they're pounding open a beehive. And I immediately thought, okay, we got to go see this. And I thought, okay, National Geographic picture, here we come. I ran towards the tree with the camera, hearing this boom, 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 pant hoots all around. And just as we arrived at the tree, we heard this, well, boom, this gigantic dead tree collapsed to the ground. We heard the chimp scream and fall through the canopy, land on the ground and run away. And so we didn't get my wonderful picture that I was hoping to get. But what we did do was we found this scene where this tree was lying on the ground, a massive old dead tree. Vines had just been snapped and vine sap was splattered around the area. We found signs of chimps just there and a hive in the tree right at our chest level now with stingless bees swarming around it. And just under that was a blunted club about this long that fit nicely in my hand. I have pictures of it.
If you're curious, for photos of the club tool Cleve found and more, check the blog on our website at talkingapes.org.
With a blunted end. And so, putting together the evidence, we concluded that was actually a honey club. And we found other examples of this too, and there have been honey clubs found at other nearby sites. This seems to be limited to Central Africa, this honey club use. But that shows you a little bit of our, how do we determine? I mean, obviously, people with habituated chimpanzees can actually see them use the tools or not use the tools if they're not using them. And we don't have that advantage, but we use all sorts of circumstantial evidence, occasional observations or camera trap footage, which we have at Beely, to determine how the chimps are using these tools.
I was wondering about the modification side of it, because I know from the couple of times that I worked at Gombe, the fishing sticks, the chimps actually modify, find a long twig or grass, and they actually modify it. So I was wondering how much of that modification you see in these sticks that you're discovering.
I would say quite a bit. And you go to my 2019 paper, you can see photos of some of these modifications. Generally, they'll break the stick off of a nearby sapling, and we'll actually go to that sapling and find where they broken it off. And then they'll actually rip off side branches, which would get stuck when they're trying to, probe for driver ants, and leaves, so that the sticks will be without leaves. You'll find little piles of leaves nearby. And very clear signs of modification. Again, not always. And for older tool sites, it's harder to see these things. But in general, I would say, yeah, most of the tools we find have been modified in some way. Now, what I find interesting is, in Central Africa, as part of this sort of tool set tradition, the chimps, Dave Morgan and Cricket Sands have documented what may be one of the rare instances of cumulative culture in stick tool use making. What they do is when they're fishing for these Macrotermes termites, the chimps will take a termite stick like you've seen it at Gombe, but what they'll do is they'll bite the end of it like this and create sort of a fan, a brush tip, they're called. And this allows them to catch more termites. They've actually tested this. And this brush stick is like a Jane Goodall Gombe's termite dipping tool, but with an extra addition. And this is where I think it's fertile ground to look for potential of cumulative culture. We have found some brush tip sticks in Beely as well, but we haven't really been able to convincingly show that they were deliberately added because the chimps aren't habituated.
Go back to Bungoma. What other things are significant or are different about the chimps there?
In northern Uganda in general, the chimps do seem to not use many stick tools. For instance, at Budongo and the Budongo Forest, there are two communities of chimps that use sponges, including moss sponges that Cat Hobater and team, they discovered this sort of innovation, switching kinds of sponges they use. But they don't use many stick tools. And Thibaut Gruber has done some fascinating work showing that there may be cultural override operating in northern Uganda, where the chimps are just not seeing sticks as potential tools. They're using leaves or something like that. Whereas in Beely, the Beely area, they have at least five different kinds of stick tools for different kinds of insects. So I don't know how that's going to fit together with the ground nesting, which seems to be maybe continuous across that entire huge area. But it's really fascinating distribution of behavior. And it's a natural laboratory, this whole area, because you still have intact chimp populations, a lot of them minimally affected by humans. So we're able to study like how chimp traditions have spread across space and time.
Hmm. The speaking of the Bungoma chimps, I read a recent piece. It was estimated there were some 600 chimps in that area, as well as other non-human primates. It's an extremely rich area for primates, but there's some new threats for sugarcane development and things like that. So how stable is this area for you guys to be able to continue doing work, or is it a conservation problem in that area?
So there is very good conservation activity in the area, but there's also this threat of sugarcane nibbling around the edges of the protected area. There's also tea plantations. There's some hunting going on in there. So, you know, it's definitely an island forest. This is big difference between Uganda and DRC. DRC has enormous, vast stretches of forest. You know, I once flew between Beely and Uganda. And a plane, and for several hours, all we saw was forest. This was like 20 years ago. I hope it's the same now, but without hardly seeing any signs of humans. Whereas in Uganda, the chimps in most of the areas are you know, although well protected, they're limited to little forest islands that are sort of being encroached on by the sides from the all sides. But on the other hand, the Ugandan conservation authorities, it's easier to get to these sites. It's easier to patrol them. It's maybe a little less dangerous than in Congo, where, you know, a lot of heroic wildlife guards have lost their lives. Just, I mean, I hate to read the headlines of stuff that's happening in Eastern Congo are being killed by charcoal mafia and things like this. So Uganda is an easier place in a way to protect the chimps, but there's less chimps to protect and they're living in more fragmented habitat, which often too the chimps come into contact with humans, and that can lead to problems as well.
Right. I want to switch back to Beely for a few minutes and talk about the cultural stuff. This idea of behavioral realm and the spread of culture. And in specifically something that you have worked on, I don't know if Tony's been involved in this, but Cleve, you have looked at stick use, and you mentioned earlier the termite mounds and the type of termites. And I think I found it really interesting, and we'll post on the blog that accompanies this a picture of, I think it's you laying down with all these different sticks around you.
My wife Sonia took that picture, at Max Planck Institute.
Just yeah, a shout I mean, it's really
to my wife.
It's a really fascinating image because it just the diversity of, especially length of sticks, I found really fascinating. Can you talk about that a little bit and weave it together with this idea of culture and cultural spread and what you're seeing?
Well, sure. We have to be careful with this C word because it's actually quite heavily contested as to whether or not you can really call what chimp traditions culture. I'm of the opinion you can. Maybe it's somewhat different from human culture in terms of there might be not as much or any cumulative culture going on. I think there are some cases where maybe the chimps have cumulative culture, not at Beely, but in other places. Regardless of whether you call it culture or traditions, there's definitely a social component to the transmission of knowledge within and between chimpanzee communities. What we're seeing is in northern DRC, for instance, across a very diverse kind of habitat. So you have south of this big Welle River, which I think is a chimpanzee barrier. This is right in the middle of the area that I surveyed. You have lush tropical forests. To the north, it's more savanna. And yet the chimps across the entire region are using multiple kinds of sticks, which are very similar to one another, to prey on the same kinds of insects. And whereas in northern Uganda, as I mentioned before, the chimps hardly ever use. There's a couple of exceptions, such as Mac McLennan's site in Bulindi. They use honey-digging sticks. But otherwise, it's like chimps in northern Uganda, they just don't see sticks as tools. And T. Bergruber has done some really great field laboratory experiments in the field showing that that it seems like chimps in populations where they use stick tools immediately figure out that, hey, I can get the honey in this sort of setup, this experimental setup to get honey. Whereas the ones in northern Uganda, they will actually, even if a stick is projecting from a honey mound, they'll actually take the stick out, even with honey on the bottom, throw the stick away, or even take the leaves off of the stick and use it to mop up the honey from this setup. So it really looks like cultural override is going. So you can contrast northern Uganda, very few stick tools, with northern DRC, a large set of stick tools used for digging up honey, used for honey probes in the treetops, very long sticks used to probe for epigaic driver ants. These really horrifying, like mass swarms of ants that will invade your tent at night. The chimps are they're tough guys. They can eat those things, and they use these very long sticks in at least north of the Welle River to get at them. Yeah, I would say that these northern DRC chimps share an elaborate stick culture. They share the ground nesting we were talking about. They share termite mound pounding, which is they seem to access their termites not by using sticks to get at them, but by pounding open Cubitermes and Thoracotermes mounds. Now, Cubitermes and Thoracotermes are found all across Africa, and no chimps that we know of pound open these mounds, except for one population, the Thai forest chimps, one community at least does this. But otherwise, chimps across Africa ignore this potential resource, whereas the Beely chimps use a non-stick tradition in order to access them and ignore the macrotermes. So we're really seeing this clustering of behavioral traits across northern DRC. I call it a behavioral realm. You can call it a cultural realm, but you're going to get in you're going to immediately find yourself in conflict with some laboratory researchers who are going to say, you can't call it culture, or it's proto-culture, or whatever you want to call it. It does seem to me the most likely explanation is you have these common these inventions of traditions in certain localized areas that then spread out through the forest to form a kind of a behavioral realm, as I've called it.
You know, one last question I had for you guys was, what is the implication of, from a conservation standpoint, what is the implication of all of this work? I read something in one of the papers talking about fortress conservation. So what, since so many of these areas, especially the Beely area, is so rife with conflict, whether it's gold mining or poaching or other things going on, politically unstable area, it seems that there's huge conservation implication for trying to keep these areas as intact, since there's so much we have to learn. What do you feel like are the conservation implications of your work and what you're doing and the areas you're doing it in?
So in the Beely area, you know, what I would say is if you try to work to protect this, again, fortress conservation, keep people out of these areas, I think it's a doomed effort, because you're basically treating the local people as the enemy. I mean, I've seen this happen. And I don't think that's, first of all, it's not ethically correct. It's a very colonialist way of working. But secondly, it's just bound to fail, because these local people, they live there. I mean, and you come and go. But if you can't work together with the local people, and not just local Zonde, for instance, but also conservationists working with ICCN, the Institut Congolais pour la Conservation de la Nature, and also Congolese researchers, you're just gaining so much. It's so much easier for Congolese to explain the value of wildlife to local people that maybe see them as more of a food resource than for you to come in with my imperfect French and my very imperfect Lingala and try and lecture people on why they should not cut the trees down. It's just a doomed effort if you don't involve the local people. And I would also say one aspect of our research with ground nests, to me, kind of illustrates that. What we found was chimps' ground nesting shuts down. So they lose this element of behavioral diversity when they're being hunted by humans. And unfortunately, a lot of Congo, they are being hunted, certainly by gold miners, but even some local populations hunt them. But if it's just humans doing their normal, like non-hunting activities, slash and burning agriculture or fishing in the forest, actually, that doesn't affect chimp ground nesting at all. The chimps and humans seem to be able to live together, and do, and you know, the only problem is the hunting. the hunting, not only with ground nesting, but probably other behaviors. So what you don't want, I don't know that necessarily it's keeping humans away from the chimps at all costs. And what are you going to use, a military force to do that? I don't agree with that. I think it ends up leading to worse things than it aims to cure. But it's basically working to encourage and certainly help fund patrols of Congolese who are out there risking their necks to protect this wildlife. We can help them. We outsiders can help them with data, with organizing surveys, with funding, most importantly, and we can help them to protect their wildlife. But I don't think it's our job to come in and save the wildlife from the Congolese. That's a terrible idea, and I think it often leads to resentment by local people. They say, why are you don't care about us, but you care about the chimps? I think it's not a trick. It's not like that. It's not a zero-sum, game? It's actually all sides can win. By protecting these areas, you're protecting the local human populations, you're supporting Congolese conservationists and researchers, and you're also saving the chimps and the elephants. So I just think it has to all be looked at as a sort of unified whole and not as trying to save the chimps without being concerned about the context in which the chimps and the humans and the elephants and everyone else lives in. I feel very strongly about that.
Tony, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think he resumed very well my thoughts as well. So I should second everything what Cliff said. And if I may ask something, there's one thing that we should be careful in when we are going in these areas which are not our own. We are coming from abroad, and we are trying to take our perspective in a new country, in a new area, and to conserve, we can put input, but it should come within the community. We can support the community, and the community will help, because otherwise, it's just throwing money in a borehole which has no end, and you're not actually conserving. You're just playing. So it's very important to put the effort in a way that it will be, and this is a discussion I had recently here with a friend. It's important not to patronize, so not to go there and decide what to do, why is important to do, but they should come up with the idea and what to do to conserve, because it's beneficial for them, it's beneficial for everyone, not only for chimpanzees and elephants, but also for any wildlife present, and their cattle or their goats, chickens, and their lives, and our lives in Europe, in America, or wherever in the world.
Very well said, Tony. And I often I see the local people as the experts, and sometimes I find myself the interpreter of what they're showing us. They know where the chimps are. They know the plants. For instance, on one of our recent papers, we had a co-author, Gerald from Uganda, who knows all the plants as if they're friends of his. He can identify them, and without him, our paper, we wouldn't have been able to talk much about plant species that the chimps use to build their nests. We need that local expertise, and that without that, it's basically like colonialist science, which I don't approve of.
You both make wonderful points. I think we do have to see it as an integration of ideas. We have Globio, our parent organization. We have a number of projects that we're starting where before any of those projects even start, we go in and do exhaustive surveys of local people's perspectives and opinions and ideas, so that we can then figure out how together to work with them on the conservation side of it around great apes. I want to thank both of you for taking the time and the technical challenges that we've had in doing this podcast. It's been great to hear all of this. And I do want to invite you both back to talk more, because I know the work that you're doing is going to continue on, and I'm sure there's going to be some amazing things come out of it. So it'd be great to have you both back on and talk more about discoveries that you're making, because it's like you've opened up this box of discovery, and we're having a tiny little peek into it right now. And I feel it feels like it's a huge, huge box of really fascinating stuff to look at. So thanks for sharing it with all of us on Talking Apes.
Our great pleasure. And stay tuned. Yeah, we got a lot more coming up that I won't talk too much about now, but I would love to come back on and we can share more.
That'd be fantastic. Again, thank you both. From you, Cleve, from Bogota, Colombia, and you, Tony, from South Africa. It's been wonderful to have you guys on Talking Apes. Thanks very much.
Great to be Bye-bye. Here. Thank you.
I want to thank Cleve and Tony for working through all of the recording interruptions and sharing their incredible journey of discovery. For more about Billy Chimps, you can find a blog and fascinating video clips and photos on our website at talkingapes.org. You've been listening to Talking Apes, the podcast that gets to the heart of what's happening with and to apes like us. Our conversations are with folks from across this planet of apes, writers, researchers, conservationists, and scientists, all getting us closer to understanding who we are and why. Because ensuring the survival of the other four great apes is the only way to ensure our own. I would like to thank our entire Talking Apes team, with a special shout out to assistant producer Demel Zaban, for all the work they do in bringing this podcast to you. And I would like to thank you, the donors and Patreon members who make Talking Apes successful through your generous support and the sharing of this podcast. If you appreciate what you hear on Talking Apes, consider supporting us. Please visit our website at talkingapes.org. Finally, I would like to thank the dedicated folks on the front line of great ape survival. We hope through Talking Apes we're able to shine a light on the unseen, selfless work you do every day to ensure great apes, primates, and their forest homes survive and thrive into the future. I'm Jerry Ellis. Thanks for listening and for sharing with family and friends the Talking Apes podcast.